Good evening and welcome to the LSE Literary Festival. My name's Charlie Beckett. I'm a professor in the Department of Media and Communications here at the LSE. I also run a think tank called Polis, which is a think tank about international journalism. And quite some time ago, I used to be a journalist, not on newspapers, though. I'm very pleased to have two speakers here tonight, one of whom is the editor of the Times Literary Supplement. That's Stig Abel, just here to my left. Stig previously worked at The Sun as the managing editor of The Sun, and before that was the director of the Press Complaints Council, which does not exist anymore, or has been transmogrified. The sharp-eyed amongst you will have spotted that that is not Janine Gibson. Janine is very, very sorry, but literally in the last couple of hours has had to cancel coming because of illness. And that's very sad, but I'm very, very pleased that she's managed to get Jim Waterson, who's the political editor of BuzzFeed, to stand in. I was tempted to try and get him to come in drag, but unfortunately you have an all-male panel. So sorry about that, but that's the end of the apologies. Tonight we're going to be talking about, newspapers in particular, and perhaps journalism in general, because I think it's become quite a hot topic, not just for journalists, but for anybody who cares about the way that we understand what's happening in this rather interesting world that we live in. But what actually sort of made me come up with this idea for this event was an article that Stig wrote, I think, in December in the New York Times, Britain's paper tigers, trying to explain to an American or global audience, you know, what had happened to this great news media, this press, in the UK. And it's, you know, we are only a few hundred metres from Fleet Street, which, as Stig refers to in the article, doesn't have any newspapers there. There may be journalists still, you know, hanging out at the Cheshire Cheese or something, but doesn't have any newspapers. So things have definitely changed. And it was a beautiful article, and I'm going to... It was beautiful. It was beautiful. It wasn't just erudite and thoughtful. It was very nicely written. I was so surprised by it. No.
I have to take a compliment. So nice.
That's right. But Stig said a couple of things in this this article that because one thing I think is, how many of you have ever, especially I don't know, in the wake of Brexit, for example, in the wake of Trump, how many of you the phrase "I blame the media" crossed your lips, you know. So there is still this sense that the media, and in the UK particularly, that newspapers are particularly influential. And Stig writes, quote, "Britain's decision to leave the European was, from one angle, a final Pyrrhic victory for British print journalism. Its fiercely partisan, predominantly right-wing newspapers had come out in support of Brexit. This was only to be expected. The mood of the country outside of its cosmopolitan capital and Europhile Scotland was stridently anti-immigration and pro-nationalism. Newspapers were both feeding and responding to that phenomenon." So in a sense, you were saying, Stig, that newspapers still have a residual power to somehow, if not dominate the conversation, to direct it.
I think it is residual. I mean, I think it's probably always been overstated,
right,
the power of newspapers. And it is residual. I think newspapers still have the ability to point in the way that the nation is feeling. And papers like The Sun and The Mail, I suppose, they know their audience. Their audience is dwindling in terms of people who are willing to pay money for a physical property like a newspaper. Their audience is increasing in the sense of their digital reach, which for both of those papers, now The Sun, which is no longer behind a paywall, is the second most read national newspaper, I saw today by Comscore. The Daily Mail is effectively a large US celebrity website with a small British print arm, which is kind of extraordinary change in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. And The problem the Mail have, the problem that everyone has, is despite being that great, large, international internet organisation, it can't monetise that audience the same way it can people buying a newspaper. So the turnover for the Mail and the Mail on Sunday print copies, despite ever reducing, still outperforms that from digital advertising. And that's never really going to change. It's the basic law of economics, supply and demand. The internet is infinite. Advertising space is infinite. Therefore, you're never going to increase your yields from purely display advertising. Now, there's things like native advertising, which is more BuzzFeed's realm, where there's a possibility to change that a bit. But ultimately, the advertising free model for journalism is kind of screwed. So the Mail has a great reach, it has a great audience, it can't really monetize it. The place that monetizes everything on the internet is Google and Facebook. We might talk about that influence on journalism. So the print model has completely changed. It's completely changed beyond recognition over the last 10 years. And it used to be a license to print money, and now it isn't. The people who have this license to print money are Facebook and Google. So newspapers have this residual power in that there's something about a hard copy artifact that carries with it a certain weight. It influences broadcasters, as you will know, in the sense of it points to a certain tone of national conversation. But the power's probably always been overstated. People didn't vote for Brexit because the Mail and the Sun told them so. The Mail and the Sun pushed Brexit because it felt very clearly that their readers wanted Brexit. And there's a kind of symbiosis of
Just think about that. This is sort of going back a little bit then, perhaps, to when you were at the Sun. How much do you think that newspapers who have got proprietors, who have got political views, they have got editors, you know, in the case of Dacre, for example, very strong ideological sense of the world. How much do you think they do actually push an agenda? Because, you know, 15 years ago, there were very few Eurosceptic MPs. Now it's the other way round. How much was that being led by Sun readers who were furious with agricultural subsidies or something, and wanted to take back control?
It's very hard to know. Are readers angry because newspapers are whipping them up, or newspapers whipping up because they're angry? And like I said, there's a kind of mutual relationship there. In the end, places like The Sun, I wasn't there for Brexit, but places like The Sun employ editors who have a certain ideological view that matches that of the proprietor. Marina Hyde wrote a big piece about how the influence of proprietors work, and very seldom is it necessarily a diktat from on high. You must cover this story in this way. It employs often like-minded people or people with a political sense either of their own or of what they believe their readers to want. And Sun readers, there was lots of polling of it, they voted for Brexit in a very high number. If the Sun had pushed a Remain agenda to that audience, it would have been a disastrous thing commercially. Now, that's not to say that people connected to making those decisions didn't believe it as well. I think it is this sort of strange symbiotic relationship. Now, whether the nature of the newspapers led to Brexit, I think the more we look at how the world is operating, this anti-elitist feeling that subsists outside of the cities. You know, if you look at France, 60% of people in France live in small towns and villages away from the big metropolitan areas. That's fertile Le Pen country. Trump wins in places like Wisconsin, which you wouldn't expect him to win. There's an anti-professional, anti-elite view of the world, which I think is spreading. And that's nothing to do with the British media or the US media or the media more generally. I think there is something of a zeitgeist there of sorts, which then places like The Sun and The Mail tap into. I don't think you could give them the credit of creating it.
Yeah. There's just another quote from this lovely article you wrote. You said, quote, many newspapers have become living relics, pale and attenuated, struggling to be significant. The Daily Mirror, a left-leaning tabloid, was once a prominent socialist voice selling more than 3 million copies. Circulation is now well below 1 million, heralding a downward spiral of staff cuts, reliance on news agency copy and articles siphoned from social media, and an enfeebled voice. The Daily Express, once a serious paper, is no more than an incontinent shriek of made-up facts about health and immigration. See, beautifully written. What I think is interesting about that is it that the newspapers were actually in decline themselves? And in a sense, it just sort of coincided with the rise of social media, that it's not so much BuzzFeed that's killed the newspapers. It's sort of long-term trends that they themselves were becoming increasingly sort of anachronistic and a bit weird.
Yeah, I don't think BuzzFeed has killed...
that's reassuring to me.
The hatchet man next to me. I think that the internet generally has made available for free what was previously paid for. Newspapers used to have a gigantic monopoly. There were monolithic institutions that shouted at their readers, and the readers really either had to accept it or go to very few other places elsewhere. So that giant monolithic shouty kind of institution of a newspaper has had to weather the complete reversal in terms of how information is traded. I mean, advertising is another critical point. The problem for newspapers like The Mirror and The Express, and you can see, you have to end, either you have to say, we'll run them at massive loss because we want to, or you cash cow them. You basically say, advertising is doing this, it will never change, we will gradually cut the product, cut the journalists, cut the quality, we'll lose more readers, so we'll cut more, so we'll lose more readers, so we'll cut more, so we'll lose more readers, and ultimately you keep your cost base as low as possible, just above, just beneath the line of your income. Now that's doable. It has one natural conclusion, which is eventually you kill the product, and The Mirror is in that cycle, The Express is in the cycle, The Star is in that cycle. The extent to which other papers get into that cycle depends on where they can find their source of revenue elsewhere. So newspapers have been absolutely battered by a complete fundamental change in how information is traded. And information, the news of the day, is traded for nothing on the internet. So a product that is based on giving you the news of the day with a spin, with a great polemical partisanship, has lost a lot of its cause for people buying it. And that is a fundamental change in how the product is consumed.
Yeah. I mean, hands up anybody who has bought a physical newspaper in the last week.
Wow. That's pretty good, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, you dinosaurs. How many people here have a digital subscription? They've either bought an app or...
Saved. It's all right. Yeah. Are you okay?
And the rest of you bastards, why are
you... Why are you here?
Why are you here? That's right. You just come to gloat, haven't you? Yeah. Jim, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I don't know if people follow Jim on Twitter or read his work, but you're a fantastic, hardcore, political... journalist. You know, most of what you do is around Westminster or related things, you know, by-elections, that kind of stuff. I just wondered, do you read newspapers, and do they sort of help frame, you know, or newspaper stuff? You know, I don't mean the physical thing.
I read everything, and the thing is, now I don't think there's ever been a better time for reading brilliant journalism. I find myself every lunch break distracted by another sort of half-hour long read on something, and then find out I haven't actually done what I was supposed to be working on, which is delivered to me for free by people I trust, and they've recommended it. There's also never been so much dross around, so it's trying to find some way between the two. In terms of papers, I joined, and as we said, I'm not Janine, I'm not a Pulitzer winner, I'm not the person you thought you'd come to see, but what I can do is give you some insight into what it's like to be at BuzzFeed from the very start. So I joined when there was 9 of us in a basement just around the corner from here. And at that point, I was considered mad for going to somewhere that published online only. I remember people saying that that was sort of a career-ending move because you didn't have the prestige of a newspaper attached. Now, my bet on that, I think, was the right one in terms of my career. But what's interesting is I'd wrongly thought that about 3 or 4 years down the line, we'd be seeing national newspapers almost irrelevant in the UK. And that's the bit that hasn't quite happened. Mm. So what we've had is we've had this odd transition. There's a couple of new entrants. There's BuzzFeed. There's HuffPo. There's a couple of others where they've come in and they've sort of become part of the same establishment. But a few other papers have actually transitioned surprisingly well. And in terms of what I read, Sunday papers still drive the news in this country. The extent to which, when you turn on the radio, they're reading out the headlines from the papers. When I go and do paper reviews on the news channel in the evening, I find it maddening that I try and say to a BBC producer, why do I have to talk about the Daily Star, which sells 250,000 copies, and yet an article that we've done, which has been read by 500,000 Brits, is not considered okay for a panel discussion on the news? It's absolutely baffling, but there is still this establishment mindset in the UK that if it's on the front page of a printed newspaper, it matters, and therefore it's worthy of debate, and it's worthy of questions in Parliament. So at the moment, I think that's the key thing that's holding newspapers in their current place in the UK. The business model, as we've discussed, has major issues. Subscriptions aren't coming in. The news stories that drive the well, apart from with the honourable exception...
No, not just about the TLS, but go on, sorry.
With the honourable exception of a few things, Mail Online gets a lot of readers, but they're not clicking on the political content, they're clicking on the celebrity content, and what Downing Street still cares about is the paper front page of the Daily Mail rather than whatever's at the top of its website. So we're in a really odd place, and essentially trying to work out where the power lies is quite a conundrum, because it still lies with the editor and the night editor choosing what goes on that front page, which gets then put on the news channel and things like that, rather than quite at the point where it's reflecting what people are reading, which is often the more clickbaity stuff and often produced by more established news brands, but not the things they put on the front page. So The Independent, The Express are quietly being read by enormous amounts of people, but not in the way that you'd think, not with the stuff that's highlighted.
I think that's a very fair summary. I do think the subscription model is more interesting than that, because what I think you're seeing is, as I say, the basis, an advertised-based model for digital, even mass market, does not add up at the minute for most people. And it is looking unlikely that ever will do. Even have places like Snapchat, which have a vast, 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 vast audience, an audience that a newspaper could never imagine having. And it said recently it can imagine a situation where it is never profitable. Yeah. And it has a billion people making use of it. The people who make money in this world are Facebook and Google. That is how... Yeah. Facebook wants to be the internet. It is becoming the internet. And it is taking, you know, a third, a fifth of all advertising just for itself. So the mass market model of advertising works only for Facebook and Google. If you look at subscription businesses... TLS is a very small example of it, but there's the FT, there's the Times, there's the Economist, there's the Spectator, there's the New Statesman. They're all profitable.
Yeah.
They're all profitable because there does appear in this world where you can read mass-marketed, even in the case of BuzzFeed, high-quality mass-marketed stuff for free. There is a sense that the counterculture to this, the analogy I use, this is not about BuzzFeed, this is about generally, is the sort of fast food rise in the 1980s created the slow food movement, people who cared about organic food, farmers' markets and the like, the counterculture.
Yeah.
Always responds to the culture. So a culture of clickbait, culture of fast, democratized, quick, easy journalism creates the converse, which in the end is complicated, in-depth, long reads. And if you find your right niche, which in the case of the TLS, the LRB, is kind of culture and literature. In the case of the FT, it's a really big niche, but it's the financial world, the financial markets. In the case of the Times, it's trying to say we are in-depth journalism that you might want to lean back and read, sort of features-y stuff, which you're not going to get as easily elsewhere. A combination of print and digital together, where you might want a kind of artifact that's beautiful and really nicely produced alongside something that's easily consumed on your mobile and iPad. You can kind of imagine that ecosystem functioning alongside an ecosystem which says, here's stuff that is freely available.
I wonder, obviously the economics is fundamental, you know.
Yeah.
Someone's got to pay for it through a license fee or something. The economics is absolutely fundamental. And to get that, you have to have attention and sustain it and so on. But I wonder what changes about the journalism. I was thinking, you just mentioned, Jim, that, you know, the BBC or whatever, when they do a papers review, will still do the papers. And in a sense, they'll echo that agenda. I was thinking about your work, that you, as I said, you do some very straight, I don't know, number crunching on who's going to win Stoke or Copeland. But you also do things like... And I know this is one you always cite yourself, your famous article, 21 pictures of politicians in wellies staring at floods.
That was fantastic as well.
It was fantastic.
We're very proud to do both. You know, we published a sort of, within half an hour of each other, we sort of published a scoop on the Chinese embassy trying to influence student societies in the UK, and we did a sort of can you recognise the shadow cabinet member quiz, to which a lot of the shadow cabinet said no, I didn't get all of them. Basically there's, coming back to that thing I said at the start about there's never been a better time for reading good journalism and there's never been a better time for reading terrible journalism. I kind of view everything as you've either got the extremely elite high quality paywalled stuff, or sometimes outside the paywall, you maybe your New Yorkers and things like that, which are read by, you know, people who just want the best, and it's got to be the best article on that topic. So when we do a long read, for instance, we put everything into it. We'll put someone on it for a week. We'll get them to report on everything. We won't do a quick one-day turnaround, because that's the only way that people who are real connoisseurs are going to read it. But equally, there's the short, sharp hit. Donald Trump just said this, and what the hell is going on? Quick, get it out there. Don't think about it. The really bad dead zone for journalism at the moment, and this is a bit of a worry for myself and in terms of sort of what it does to democracy, is that sort of middle ground, the sort of medium-length standard newspaper report yesterday in Parliament. The Prime Minister announced this, and here's a little bit of context, but not a great conspiracy theory. Because that's not what gets shared. That's not what gets read online. And that's the sort of stuff which is kind of the backbone. That's the kind of like your greens that you have to eat to make sure you understand what's going on in the world. And right now, my fear is that basically the only place where a lot of Britons are getting that from is the BBC website. And as long as that remains sort of part of what they're reading, then we're all right. But if that dips out, or if anyway people end up just relying on Breitbart, or frankly on just The Independent or something like that, which is equally as happy to distort facts and do things in that way, then we're in quite a bad place. And what looking at what certain newspapers are doing to adapt online is very interesting. We did some analysis on fake news, which I asked Charlie to comment on, and the thing we found was actually fake news doesn't really exist in the UK. The issue is much more that traditional newspaper websites are doing the standard bullshit that they've always done, the standard exaggeration, the standard spin on things, and doing it incredibly well for a Facebook audience, and that the Express and the Independent were the two at the top, one on the left and one on the right, putting their own spin on the facts. So newspapers and quite how they fit into all of this is kind of terrifying. But basically, I do think you're going to end up with either commodity, fast, slightly trashy stuff, and long, in-depth stuff, perhaps behind a paywall. And yeah, trying to find that middle ground, which is being provided by people like The Times, you know, you might struggle to find that for free.
Yeah,
and that's very fair. I mean, in some ways, it's heartening because I think British people historically are both sceptical and cynical. And in a way that one of the things I think that's shattered the American media consciousness is they're not really used to journalists being criticised. Whereas if you grow up in journalism in this country, you're very used to journalists being criticised. People bring with it their views against certain organisations, sometimes legitimate. Certainly, they bring a certain amount of cynicism to bear. What's happened in America with the phenomenon of Trump and fake news is that's a real new world for them, where you're either with us or against us. And if you believe Trump, you can't believe the media establishment. If you believe the media establishment, you can't believe Trump. And I think that's a kind of seismic shock to a lot of Americans.
Yeah, there's also this really odd thing in terms of what we all think the media is. Because I still do the thing that I think most Britons do, is I think of the media as the newspapers plus the BBC and ITV, maybe. And I basically grew up online, on forums. You know, I spent all my teenage years sort of on forums and things like that, and it was always overlaid on top of this traditional media establishment. And I think what's happened is we've ended up, everyone's taken this old idea, and we're all spending all our time on Facebook, all of our time on the internet, and haven't realised that maybe the media is things like the Lad Bible. You know, that has a bigger reach than most newspapers, and yet we still like to think of The Sun issuing an apology as sticking it to the man, even though that apology might be read by more people than read the original article in the newspaper. There's a bit of a disconnect between what the media actually is now and what we all like to think it is.
Yeah. I mean, the BuzzFeed audience, as I understand it, isn't all millennials. You know,
it's anyone who uses the internet.
Yeah, it's got quite a good crossflow. But you, anyway, are sort of a millennial type person. I wondered what you.
I'm representing the whole generation.
That's right, exactly. Let's simplify things.
Okay.
But I'm intrigued by what you think will happen, because to me it does seem that the forces of sort of disintermediation and the distribution of news is so much on these networks now. And that seems like a sort of irresistible force towards whatever you want to call it, fragmentation and so on. You know, that people are going to come across stuff not on a website or an app, but just in those networks. Do you think that that's how the readership's going? Or do you think there's an element of, as you perhaps get older, you might settle down into your chosen brands?
I think it's worse with old people. We honestly think one of the worst things that's happened to politics is old people getting Facebook.
Yeah.
So yeah. I say, yeah, I'm talking
the world generally.
I'm talking, basically, I'm talking. You know, I don't have that many elderly relatives on it, but the sort of the typical, the slightly racist uncle who's ended up with a Facebook account, and he doesn't really understand the language of the internet. He doesn't really understand civility. So he sort of wades into your comments when you've posted an interesting discussion and starts ranting a bit, and you don't quite know how to shut this down. And then you see that another one of his friends has joined in, and it's suddenly all out of control. And that is genuinely one of the things. So these people have sort of got used to believing that if it's published, it's probably true. Whereas the sort of cynicism, which if you spent long enough on the internet, just because you spent your formative years doing that, that you grow up with, isn't there. So that is actually one of the main things that we see quite a lot, is the sort of the racist elderly person sort of wading in on the comments.
And it's hard to overstate the influence of Facebook on the media landscape, because it's like crack cocaine for newspaper companies, because your audience, what you want is, you want your audience to come to your website, to bookmark your website, to spend time there, to bounce around, to be fed adverts, and actually probably now to be sold products that you own a stake in, because that's the way people are going to make money. They're going to have some display advertising, which won't do very much. There'll be some native advertising, which will do a bit. And then you're going to try and sell them stuff that you own as a product. That's the kind of economy, such as it is, of the free digital world. What Facebook does is say, we control the audience. 80% of your traffic's going to come from us. We want to be the internet. We're going to sell them advertising. We're going to keep the data. And so newspapers are locked in this kind of love-hate struggle with Facebook, this kind of weird sort of clasp that's half an embrace and half an attempt to throttle each other. Because ultimately, Facebook have what newspapers, journalism needs, which is an audience. And they know that. And therefore, they control, I think, the means of distribution.
Yeah, so completely. I mean, almost all of BuzzFeed's readers come from people sharing something on Facebook or Twitter. And that's so an endorsement. They liked it, or they were shocked by it, or they reacted in some way to it to the extent that they felt they had to post it out to all their friends. The really scary thing, though, is that basically means that all distribution of all news is a lot of people trying to second-guess one algorithm. Yeah. And as soon as you find the odd word that fires some synapse in a brain, I remember years ago, one of the earliest ones we found was we were doing lots of quizzes at the time, and if you put the word actually in a headline, your click-through rate went up about a third. So, which LSE lecture room are you? Versus which one are you actually? You know, suddenly everyone wants to just, there's just something that fires a different synapse. So you end up reverse engineering it, and there's certain words that just fire people off. And you see, particularly I noticed with The Independent in the UK, it's very good at just pushing something right to its limits. And rather than trying to second guess your audience, trying to sort of reflect the story, we see a lot of people who share articles without ever clicking through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see them, quote retweeting it with, this is disgusting. And then you reply and go, have you read it? Because in the third paragraph, it completely contradicts the headline. And they go, oh, yeah, no, that's, I'm really glad you pointed that out, actually. So, you see whole comment pieces off the back of the headline when clearly no one has actually read the piece. And, it's not unknown for you to see something get more retweets than it's had click-throughs. I mean, we really are in a slightly disturbing world in which people are just reading the headlines in a way that they...
And what that means for Facebook, Joe, is so their revenue, for example, if you take a six-month revenue from online advertising for Facebook, it will be something like $4 billion globally. If you combine all the revenue of all the news producers in that six-month period, it would probably be $200 million. So all the people paying the journalists, paying for Jim to go out there and actually do journalism, paying, even if you disagree with it, all the journalism sites that you're aware of, paying journalists to produce stuff, they're taking $200 million total from advertising. At the same time, Facebook, which as soon as you say, well, hang on, are you not a bit responsible for how this stuff is being shared? They go, no, we're a platform, we're not a publisher. We don't want any of the grief of this stuff. This stuff is expensive, it's risky, you can get sued, you can get data protection problems, you can get all the grief you're associated with the garnering of information. We don't want that side of it. We'll take the $4 billion. Thank you very much. And we will own all of the audience. And so you will come on bended knee begging us, please let your algorithm recognize us. We'll produce video because your algorithm tells us, is saying that they want video. We don't care the cost of it. We don't care if it's crap. Every story has to have a crap video because Facebook algorithm loves video. And that relationship is what is, to a large extent,
dictating the content.
It is astonishing. I mean, just a really boring technical one, but this shows you the power that Facebook has over newsrooms. So a couple of years ago, if you use Facebook, you'll have noticed suddenly out of nowhere, all these subtitled videos were coming, you know, on news. Everything was subtitled. It was a bit like, you know, the world explained for dummies with a few moving images in the background. And then a month or so ago, Facebook said, actually, we're going to turn sound on all videos by default. And suddenly all of these sort of design teams, all of these templates, everything is being ripped up because someone in the west coast of US decided that they wanted something slightly different because that suited their advertising needs a bit better. And all the plans are going to change, everything that's going to be formatted differently, and your whole experience will change because the main distributor of news is going to tell you that you're going to enjoy it in a different way, and you will because you don't have any choice.
And as Mr. Zuckerberg was saying this week, you know, that they want to be the global community. But I wonder,
they are
indeed already to some extent. But I wondered, apart from the economics, which is again terribly important, but I wonder what it does to the sort of quality, if you like, of news or journalism when you live on Facebook. So, for example, you know, the debate about that we definitely, as you referred to, we've got more sources of journalism than ever before. And if you think back to the analog age when we were all Guardian readers or Sun readers or Telegraph readers, we didn't swap those newspapers around. We were quite blinkered. But I wonder what you think it's changed in the quality of news or the consumption, especially thinking about, you know, well, you said the word democracy.
So the one positive, I do genuinely think it's a lot harder to write completely made-up bullshit journalism now. And we've internally been using bullshit journalism to differentiate from fake news, sort of, because you can't quite tell the difference sometimes. But if we take fake news as being completely made up and bullshit journalism as sort of being the stuff that's not quite true but stretching the facts. And it is hard. You can't really get away with complete fabrication in a way now. There's always going to be someone to call you out on Twitter very quickly. There's always going to be someone to get the complaint into Ipso if you're a newspaper. So I think in some respects it's harder if you're a mainstream publisher to get away with outright lies. So that's a positive of sorts. And it also is harder to justify your existence if, you know, in my field, political journalism, you're the sort of lobby hack who just turns up, copies what the Press Association put out a few hours early and puts your own byline on it. That's a lot harder to get away with now. You have to be coming up with original stuff or be doing it differently. Mm. So there's definitely some positives in that respect.
What about the bias thing? Because, I mean, BuzzFeed has a, you know, I feel you have a kind of liberal ethos generally.
Yeah,
but you don't. You're not identifiable in the way.
No,
that
and we'd never ever talk about. We don't do comment pieces. We'd never ever endorse a political party. We'd never ever go down the route of saying that someone was right or using sort of too many scare quotes in a piece to imply that, you know, the government is on the brink of collapse, says Labour MP sort of headline.
Even about Trump in the US?
Well, about Trump, Trump is a very strange case. Trump is... Trump, I mean, never has there been a president on which you can do so much journalism that appears to be attacked but is basically just, you know, scratching the surface. There's a lot to dig into on that man. We had certainly been trying to work out what we'd do with a Hillary Clinton White House, which would have less obvious plot lines of attack in order to do it. We certainly don't expect to be getting any access to the Trump White House anytime soon, so it's a case of finding stories however we can. And as the president himself says, we are a failing pile of garbage. So
that's the best endorsement you can
that's
have.
That's the best endorsement.
New York Times put 500,000 subscribers since Donald Trump became president. So every time he... I wish he'd tweet. I've been trying to provoke him on Twitter.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I'm absolutely desperate because we did a cover about Clinton and misogyny and how she was treated, and I was tweeting it at him. Can you possibly just criticise the TLS just once? Because I think we'd get 10,000 extra subscribers out of it. I mean, I do think we live in a world, of course, where if someone like Jim quotes, and it's the same is true actually of Corbyn to a certain extent and Trump, people who excite passions in both directions, and Corbyn is that figure, I think, to a much lesser extent, but still appreciably so in this country. If you write a piece that simply quotes what they've said, you very often will get accused of being a smear attack. And now, the killer thing, fake news, the term that started out as this interesting phenomenon, which was effectively discovered or really analysed by BuzzFeed at the time, just of the American election, is now this catch-all shriek of, I don't agree with you. I have a radio show on LBC on a Sunday, and I did an hour about whether Donald Trump had the mental capacity to continue for 4 years as president. It was, you know, thoughtful, non-partisan stuff. And what happens when you do that? the rage comes in from people who are just saying that, you liberal snowflake. I was called a leftard and things like that. There's horrible words that now seem to exist in the lexicon. But what happens is, they don't say, I disagree with you because you're an idiot, although there's that sentiment certainly expressed. They say, you're fake news. You're fake news. When you say that Donald Trump did this, it's fake news. You're exactly what he's talking about. And it becomes this horrible, self-fulfilling thing, because he says ridiculous things, the media quote him on it, he criticises the media, so the media quote him on it. Meanwhile, both sides are shouting fake news at each other in ever-increasing volumes. What became this phenomenon that's worthy of consideration, how people in Macedonia are cynically trying to create nonsense for clicks, has now become this catch-all phrase of, you're from a different side of the fence to me and I disagree with you. And who's the chief cheerleader of that? The most powerful man in the world. It is an extraordinary situation.
But there's a sort of posher version of that, isn't there? The sort of there's the phrase post-truth, where again there was a lot of that from, you know, intelligent, high-minded liberals in the UK after Brexit, who felt that we were in a post-truth society because they had lost, you know, the Remain camp had lost, and that must be because people hadn't got proper information. So it's not just Trump, is it? There's a more...
Well, I'd also say we're noticing a lot with doing debunks of things in the US that the left is increasingly getting almost as bad as the right for believing almost anything about Donald Trump.
That's true.
There's these conspiracy... You know, you sort of see someone who starts a Twitter thread of 20 tweets sort of explaining how one decision made 10 years ago links up to why Donald Trump is now in power, and it's all this shadowy man in the middle. And because there's enough true stories like that around, it immediately goes viral and it gets written up everywhere. And as soon as you actually poke any holes in it just collapses.
Yeah.
So,
and that's the problem. There's a kind of difficulty that American journalists have, which is they're on this tripwire now. Sorry, this tightrope. Because if they screw up, and everyone screws up, journalists will always screw up. It's the nature of the business. It's an incredibly hard business to get right, even if you go into it with the purest of motives, which not everyone does. But it's really, really difficult with the information bouncing around as quickly as it does. There's multiple sources. It's really hard to get stuff right. The problem in America is if you get something wrong on Trump, which we've seen that Time journalists said that he'd got rid of the...
Martin Luther King
bust. And it was a genuine mistake, I'd like to think, and I don't know this guy, I'm sure it was, but it was massively amped up as a story, then he retracted it, and that retraction probably wasn't amped up as much as the story. And now when Trump gets the idiot Spicer to go and stand and talk about fake news, he will say... Look at Time magazine screwing that up. And that's a problem as well, because journalists will make mistakes and they've got to try to enter into it with pure motives, because if they make mistakes from malign motives, it's going to make the situation even worse.
The real thing muddying the waters here, and this is so far off newspapers, is the sort of crossover between activist people and reporters and the blurring of the line. I mean, one example was there was a seminar at which a policy analyst said, and I bet they even turned off the tapes when Trump met Putin, or at least talked to him on the phone. Someone in the crowd tweeted this. Someone else picked this up and said, oh my God, if Obama had done this, then he'd be impeached by now. This then got written up as fact. It was incredibly viral. We reckon it was shared, you know, several hundred thousand times on Facebook in various forms. And there's no evidence for it. It was one sort of slightly misquoted comment that got retweeted, that got some sort of commentary added, ended up on left-leaning activist sites. And before you know it, there's probably millions of people who still think that, you know, there was some conspiracy to turn off the tapes versus a few hundred thousand who read our debunk article. So
it's that febrile atmosphere we've entered into, and that's the thing. And Trump is largely to blame for this. And it's wrong to say to the US media is wrong to focus on him, because he is saying and doing extraordinary things, and lots of times they are simply playing tapes of what he says in public or what his spokesman says in public. So they have a job to do, and it's understandable they will be very critical of Trump, because what he's saying is so worthy of criticism, very clearly. But it's created this febrile atmosphere where if you have a party political view, left or right, the temptation to do a piece with a clicky headline that says you won't believe what Trump did next or what happened when Trump met Putin, knowing that you'll get 50,000 people immediately going to it, not that in the end you make any money from it, which is a kind of pervading irony of all this. This clickbaity stuff is not actually going to save the day.
We could double our traffic if we changed our headlines to be openly partisan. Yeah. I mean, we really could. I mean, the fact that we still try to maintain, you know, Donald Trump said this comment, you know, maybe allow extraordinary in the headline, but we're not going to say, you'll never believe what Donald Trump said, the right-wing nut job, because, you know, which would actually do so much better online, but we wouldn't quite put it that far.
In a second, I'll take questions from you lot, so if you want to say something or ask something, get yourselves ready. I just think, going back to where we started, Stig, I just wonder how different that is to an era when we had newspapers which were similarly, you know, partisan and aggressive. I know you can't really answer this, but I wonder whether that, because it felt to me that changed in the last 10, 15 years, that newspapers became even more views papers. They became even more.
I don't have enough of a historical perspective on that. I think newspapers have always been aggressive, but they had a monopoly on aggression.
Right.
And that was a real critical change. That, you know,
we've democratised aggression.
We have precisely what we've done. And we've democratised partisanship, and newspapers could do it, and you could take or leave it. If you were part of the readership of The Guardian or The Sun or The Mirror, you knew what you were getting. There was always some countervailing balance of things like the BBC, the 6 o'clock news, the 10 o'clock news, that kind of appointment to view, which would kind of make an attempt to be balanced. In the end, people are deeply partisan creatures, and you see this in broadcast news. I'm sure you must explain. You know, no one would argue that you can't guess the politics of Channel 4 News, for example.
Yeah.
It's screamingly obvious. It's a very good show. It's very good journalism. The politics are absolutely screamingly obvious to anyone watching it, because that's how human beings behave. And before, there was papers doing it, broadcasters, for legal reasons, making an attempt to be balanced, and that was an ecosystem that, while it had its massive faults and massive difficulties, there's a kind of sense of equilibrium there a little bit. You then have that still at times where there's less money, there's less quality journalism because there's fewer reporters covering more, plus you throw in social media, plus you throw in this activist journalist combination, then you throw in a president who is a kind of gogglebox president,
yes, right,
who sort of sits there, watches telly and tweets about it, and then forms his opinions on it. And you've ended up with something that is kind of completely careering out of control.
I wonder, what do politicians say to you about this?
Well, that's
are they feeling that they need to act differently?
Yeah, I notice it's a real generational divide. Yeah. If they're under about 35, as amazingly we now have a substantial number of MPs who are, they tend to be driven by what's on Twitter, what they're seeing on their friends' Facebook. They're normal people. They pick up news in the same way as us. And whereas the older ones still care massively about getting that editorial in The Sun, and they do care massively, which gives The Sun a lot of power still, where the younger ones are much more concerned by, is that New Statesman blog nice about me? Is that thing that's trending on Twitter good? You know, what's BuzzFeed or HuffPo writing? They really care much more about that, and they're driven by, you can see this sometimes. I mean, you see sometimes someone tweet something, and then you can see the MP in the chamber checking their phone, and then you can see a few minutes they're asking a question about it. I've seen that happen myself. And that is actually one minor aside, is that a lot of MPs spend a lot of time in the House of Commons chamber waiting for a speech, checking Twitter, and you notice so often that something that's tweeted out in that five-minute gap before.
And that's quite dangerous, though, isn't it? Because Twitter, we all use it and love it, because we're sort of media people, and Twitter is saturated. But it is, it's, first of all, it's hugely unrepresented.
Massively.
I mean, it's, I don't know, 5% of the population go anywhere near it, really. And the ones that do are all a bit mad. And when they are, they're angry.
Yeah.
And it encourages a kind of binary approach to community. So that's not a good thing,
is it? If Twitter is real, Ed Miliband is the Prime Minister, we're still in the European Union, and Hillary Clinton is President of the United States of America.
That's right. And Piers Morgan is dead.
It swings and roundabouts, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, listen, anybody like to ask a question? Right, great. Loads of people would like to ask a question. Okay, should we just work from left to right? The lady in the black top there?
So I was thinking of this term which was made long back in advertising, that if you're not buying, you're the product. And I was just wondering that if in the online space today, it's still valid, because in the end, I think you become a victim and not a product. What do you guys think?
Well, yeah.
You mean the readers, as, or users, as they're now called? Yeah, users. It sounds like you're a drug addict. Yeah.
What are the victims now?
They're, like what you were saying, really, that they. That's what to Facebook they're.
That is certainly the case. I mean, actually, advertisers, in a funny way, matter less outside of Facebook because lots of people run ad blockers. Lots of people don't click advertising. And like I said, there's a fascinating thing that people rightly said newspaper presses were this great obsolete technology that's too expensive to maintain. It's very expensive to put out a newspaper. What's weird now, it's very expensive to put out a website. And the architecture of a website is actually a massive overhead that you can't monetize by using advertising because either people are running ad blockers or they're getting their stuff out of Facebook, so they're never going to see BuzzFeed's advertising because they're seeing Facebook advertising.
Except I'll plead the one exception is that we don't run display ads, so actually we luckily escape ad blockers because our whole business model is based on native advertising where we have a separate team who produce videos, who produce lists for brands. So to a certain extent, we don't make more or less money if I get more or less traffic. It's not directly linked like that. So we're trying to plough this third furrow, and hopefully for my career prospects it'll work out.
And in a sense, the subscription model of the FT or The Economist similarly tries, and indeed, of course, you know, you don't sort of sell, not yet anyway, TLS underwear, but you know, you're trying to develop a relationship which isn't just about...
Well, if you look, I mean, The Economist makes a lot of money out of events.
Yeah.
The FT makes money out of sponsored content and, you know, those papers that they do. In the end, I think BuzzFeed do it very, very well, that sort of native advertising content that that a brand wants them to produce, that BuzzFeed thinks is good enough content to sit as content and an advertiser thinks is going to sell a product. And that's kind of clearly delineated and it makes sense. The third way for newspapers is to become the advertiser themselves. So you have to have a product to sell. So The Sun has created Sun Bets because it wants to have an advert for something that it will own as well. And you'll see that in other areas. The Guardian runs masterclasses. The New York Review of Books has a book division.
Yeah.
So I think it's plausible for the TLS, for example, you could get to a situation where you do have other products. You are selling writing courses or you're selling events or you're selling something because then you kind of cover your bets a bit on advertising. You're essentially saying, we'll try and make money at both ends of it. You know, the Daily Mail did that massive thing. They still do it a bit where they've got a deal with a clothing company. So every time they run a picture of some celebrity, they find out what the dress is, who sells it, and then they have an immediate click here to buy the dress. It's massively time-consuming and person-consuming and also soul-destroying for the person doing it.
I do think it's great that you can't really pay much money to The Guardian online, but you can pay 300 quid to learn how to be a journalist with The Guardian, all these masterclasses that they're always selling to sort of train you.
And overall, I mean, I don't know if this was lurking behind your question, but in a way I think the user, the consumer, actually has more power, both economically and just generally, you know, that you can now tweet at Jim to say you disagree with what he's said or how wonderful he is. You know,
let's do the latter.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Let's take another question. Let's keep working across. Gentleman there. That's you, yeah.
Yeah, great. Hi there. So one of the things that, you know, you've talked about with regards to the sort of collapsing advertising revenue is obviously there are fewer journalists and journalists are paid less. Also, there's a problem for young journalists, because obviously, if you want to get into the industry, you actually have to make money doing it. So two of the things that are sort of happening is, one, the local roots journalism is gone. You know, if you want to go to journalism, you can't just go work for the Manchester Evening News or the Express and Echo, because, you know, you don't get your stories out there. And secondly, there's almost a culture that you have to buy a ticket now. So a lot of people do, you know, the City Course or, you know, various other things to get in. So the impact of that, of course, is that if you're not from a sort of upper middle class background where your parents can sort of give you their contacts in the industry to go do the internships, or you buy your ticket, there's no way in. What impact do you think that's going to have over the next 10 to 20 years on the industry?
I think it's a brilliant point, and it's entirely true. I mean, the BBC have always had a little bit of that problem themselves, which is that to get in at the BBC, you very often needed to be able to work in London for 2 years without being paid, or being paid very little. So you had to have a contact, you had to have very rich parents or parents who lived in the southeast. There's a massive problem of the production line of good journalists, because you're going to have companies that want to invest in journalism from the beginning. So most newspapers run schemes. So News Corp, where I work, runs a scheme. The Daily Mail runs a scheme. They will do that, but that's not going to attract a large number of people. And they pay for it. You know, it's not done free. So there is money behind it. the local news thing is a real killer, because I do think that used to be a route where someone would have 2 years of doing journalism, of journalism of talking to people, knowing how a court report works, knowing what contempt of court means and why you should avoid doing it at all costs. That route is kind of disappearing. So the burden will go on to companies. You know, BuzzFeed will presumably run a scheme.
Yeah, so we have a real problem hiring people because in their late 20s, for instance, 5 years ago when that cohort was going in, no one was hiring. There weren't the websites coming in to take up the slack, and there weren't the sort of people, you know, papers weren't hiring either. And the real problem is we're finding that people, if you've spent your 20s churning 10 articles a day, when we come along to an interview, we'll hire you, but we just need to see some evidence of you breaking stories or doing something original. They say, look, I'd love to do that, but I've never been let out of an office in 5 years. And you go, well, how can we take a punt on you? We don't know that. So one of the things that we're doing is we have a complete ban on unpaid work experience. We have a complete ban on internships that you get through asking from people. And we 3 times a year run a fellowship scheme where we take on 4 people straight out of uni, train them up for 3 months, and normally 1 or 2 of them gets a full-time job at the end of it. And certainly our news fellowship, where we've done that twice now, we've taken on 2 young female Londoners who both went to Brunel, not to City or anything like that, and they've been 2 of our best reporters that we've hired in ages, and they're absolutely killing it, both in terms of what they're producing journalistically and in terms of the amount of traffic they get. But it took a lot of management time and effort to do that.
Just quickly, one consequence, you see this a lot, there's a real fastidiousness about face-to-face journalism. So there's a lot of reporters out there whose idea of contact is direct messaging someone on Twitter or Facebook. So the notion of knocking on someone's door and saying, I'm from so-and-so, would you like to talk?
Or even just ringing them. Even,
we've had to offer landline training.
Yeah. That's and you see it sometimes, you know, the notion that journalists might go to someone's house is met with horror among the Twitterati. What was that journalist harassing that person by trying to speak to them face-to-face? It's disgusting. I've had that. People saying that to me, well, that's appalling behaviour to knock on someone's door, because that's not how people have... Now, if that person, if there was a tradition of people coming out of Manchester Evening News or wherever, that's what they would have done for... They'd have had a local patch, that have known everyone all over that place, that have knocked on doors, that have met people face-to-face, and that culture is slowly draining away.
It is indeed, says the man who started on the South London Press.
Well, there you go.
Let's go right to the back, please. The woman with her hand up, obviously. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. The challenges you talked about in terms of newspaper journalism, can you also apply that to trade magazines and magazines in general?
I think magazines have a bit of a niche built into them. So I think that as we look at models that are potentially successful, magazines tend to have a focused audience. They tend to be a product that is glossy or beautiful, that translates well to a print and digital combination. So I think there's a certain part of the magazine audience industry that is kind of healthy now, and possibly the healthiest it's ever.
Well, there's some of it. I think it's basically the serious ones are doing quite well, but the glamorous ones are doing less well. And I think that's partly because there's just a lot more glamour, sex, clothing on social media generally.
Well, that's a really good point.
So Condé aren't doing so well, but the Statesman and the are doing quite well.
And here's the thing, and that's probably very true actually, because one of the things that some titles have found, and I think this is true to a certain extent of The Sun and The Mail, is their USP became the internet. And so if you wanted funny, gossipy, scabrous, aggressive, punchy, partisan stuff, you get it everywhere. And I think possibly that's true if you want fashion or glamour or that type of stuff. You're getting that on blogs, you're getting that on websites only. So if it's become so democratized that the internet has taken it for free, I think it's very hard to build a real clear business model around it.
Yeah, trade mags, just really quickly on those, I don't know about the business model, but journalistically, I think they're in some ways better than they've ever been, and it's never been a better time, if you're working a trade mag, to get your story out there. particularly housing sector ones. Health Service Journalism, Health Service Journal has basically been running the NHS story for the last year, breaking story after story after story. And because their journalists find it easier to get to national journalists than ever before, they get credit. Whether that does much for their business model, I don't know.
And that's kind of that's a terrifying point that I don't know the answer to, because it's such a good point about Health Service Journal. Does that make money? It does make money. In which case, there's a kind of benefit.
Well, I think it does.
It's sold at a massive profit.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's partly because it's kind of news that people will pay for, because they will benefit directly in a career sense, literally. You know, if you work in the health service, and the health service journal, keep your head. Anyway, let's take another one. Let's come right down to the middle, gentleman, right in the middle here. Thank you.
A lifetime ago, I was a photojournalist for about 20 years.
You were what, sorry?
Photojournalist.
Sorry, I didn't catch that. Yeah.
And so I watched what has happened to photography and now videography as it switched over to the internet, and has been one of the great booms. I left when my editors started handing small cameras to writers, and I'm wondering now, the difference between an organization like the New York Times or the BBC that hire professional photographers and get professional work, and the organizations that assume that every writer happens to have a phone and therefore is a photographer. And I'm wondering how things break down now as you see it in your part of the world.
Because obviously you're a very... You know, BuzzFeed is a very visual...
Yeah, I mean, one good thing is, I think, sort of, for a start, previously every news story used to have an image at the top of it, so at the very least there's a lot more licensing of images going on. But in terms of how we operate, video is very hard to get right and make money from online, because you have to be in the right place at the right time to get the really newsworthy thing, and that requires sending someone out for a long time. The odds are that one explosion, that one shocking moment, is much more likely to happen when a random member of the public is passing with an iPhone than it is someone with a high-quality camera to make it look good. So I think that's one of the reasons, is just that the sort of proximity of people to newsworthy events is always going to be skewed in favor of normal members of the public. And in terms of how we report, quite often it's the terrible, grainy 30-second film I took on my iPhone of something funny happening which goes incredibly viral, and not the professional photographer that we've hired in to take the photos to accompany the piece. So it's, I don't know, I know it's sort of sitting on the fence, but it's both very good time for sort of shooting beautiful photos that are recognised the world over for capturing a moment, and also not great for run-of-the-mill stuff, which is probably the theme from this evening's event, if anything.
It's, I think from I remember when I was at The Sun, there were probably two staff photographers. If you go back 10, 15 years, there are probably 25.
Yeah.
If you talk to anyone in Fleet Street, you know, if you ever do a magazine, a sort of interview thing, you'll talk to a photographer who comes to do. I used to work at The Times, I used to work at The Guardian, but now I'm freelance, trying to make a living doing sort of commissioned pieces. So I think to take beautiful photographs that are really high quality, there is a market, there are high quality magazines that will pay for it. The notion that newspapers will support someone on staff has gone in the first wave of cuts probably 10 years ago. The downside of what Jim's talking about, he's absolutely right that a lot of good stuff is taken very quickly by people. There became a thing for journalists about 5 years ago, because Facebook prioritised video, that you sent journalists out to make very bad video pieces to accompany their story. And so you'd read a piece which was perfectly well written because the journalist knew how to write a story, and then be a video that was almost unwatchable because they knew I had no idea how to make a video. But you had to have a video.
Newspaper journalists are terrible at being on camera almost always and should never be allowed to do that. And it's very strange that we still seem convinced that if you just give someone an iPhone and a selfie stick that they can make a three-minute news package.
But the aesthetics has changed, isn't it? In the sense that it's partly because of the tech. I mean, this camera is probably better than most cameras I've ever owned, you know. You know, you've got things like the YouTubers who are literally sitting on the end of a bed talking, and people love it. And why not? Because people care about the communication, not the framing and the lighting, particularly, you know. So in a sense, the standard may have fallen in some senses, but people love it. Let's take another question. I haven't gone over this side this one. At the end here.
Yeah, hi. Just looking over the horizon a little bit, in the entertainment industry, it's been upended because people are looking at entertainment as soft power. So you've got people like Netflix, Amazon, a lot of Chinese companies moving in there, money no object, different sort of business model. Do you see news as maybe being in the future a version of soft power that might be very attractive to some of those organisations?
I think the audience might be attractive. I mean, I mean, it seems to me that the internet model is not that different to how it was in the first bubble, which is get an audience and hope a big business will buy you, which is, of course, what Snapchat's...
Yeah, because
it's kind of what Snapchat's doing, and it's kind of WhatsApp. I mean, how's WhatsApp ever going to make any money? It's got 3 billion people using it, doesn't have any advertising. How's it ever going to make any money? It's got to hope that Facebook or Google or Amazon will buy it. And it will buy it to get its audience. It might buy it to get its...
Facebook owned.
In fact, well, there you go. But they might do the same with Snapchat that Amazon bought at Washington Post, or the owner did. I think people might buy an audience that way. And I think in certain titles, they might buy a brand that they feel matches their brand nicely. Now, whether that means lots of news organisations will be saved by that, I'm not so convinced. I think it's possible that you could get the right brand marriage and you'd be buying an audience and a kind of affiliation.
So one thing that happens with, certainly my own habits with Netflix and Spotify, is that you tend to gravitate towards the absolute best stuff. So the days of you'd come home and you'd watch something mediocre because that was all that was on BBC One are kind of gone. I come home and I don't even think of seeing what's on live TV. I go, what's that thing I'm watching on Netflix at the moment? If I'm thinking of music, I'm not going, what's that new album I bought that was all right? No, I'm going straight to, you know, that playlist of my favourite songs ever to listen to the absolute best stuff. And it's like, again, I think it's going to come back to this with journalism, that it will be the same. And basically, audiences will gravitate towards quality. So slightly going on the soft power thing, I'm not quite sure how you trick people, basically. I think people are quite discerning when it comes to things that they're about to invest a lot of time in.
Yeah, but it's, I don't know if I've got the soft power bit right, but there is still a sort of power. I mean, we were saying at the beginning that newspapers per se are perhaps less powerful, but there is still something about journalism that has value to either corporation, the governments, you know, that it, to have that influence.
Well, I assume everyone in this room, even the sort of lowest selling paper, The Guardian, if you're on the sort of front page quoted, you'd all be sort of ringing up your grand to say, look, you know, go and buy it, I'm on this, it really matters. Even if you weren't necessarily reading it day to day in print yourself, you still have this attachment to it.
And I think the New York Times is a good example. I mean, New York Times called the election very badly wrong, in the same way that everyone did. But you wouldn't say the New York Times doesn't have power and influence. I mean, in some ways it's dictating Trump's behaviour because it's writing stories that annoy him, and he's immediately responding to it. So I think there is power, but I think high quality stuff you could imagine being used as a sort of brand affiliate. I think that is that is possible. I'm not sure it's going to be the answer to lots of business models.
I always had a theory that Waitrose should buy The Guardian, just because there's a kind of consumer, there's a kind of crossover thing there, quinoa and stuff, you know, that, and it could horribly come true. Oh gosh, loads of people.
Can we
just come right down? Let's be really quick, because there's so many good questions. This guy here has been, sorry, right at the front, because the person at the front always gets ignored. That's bad seating choice.
Hi, thanks. You mentioned earlier that Facebook has become this global community, and I think when you consider companies like Google and Facebook, they're American companies, they're Silicon Valley companies, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who wouldn't agree with calling them global communities or global institutions, whereas the traditional British press, they're British institutions, they're monolithic. You can see it through community campaigning. You can see it through MPs who know how to reach the voters in their constituencies depending on what they read most, and they've grown up in their constituencies all that time. As the traditional British press declines and Facebook and Google, they grow, and HuffPost, they grow and grow, how much do you think that contributes to the erosion of a British national identity?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you see some papers like the FT and the Daily Mail are becoming increasingly global institutions. I mean, the Daily Mail, as I said, is an American gossip website in terms of its reach. I think you used to be able to say 10 years ago, if you wanted a sense of what Britain was, maybe this is still true, if you listed Private Eye, The Sun, The Mail and The Guardian, for example, you would affect it. And an alien came down and they said, what the hell is Britain? And you said, here's Private Eye taking the piss out of it all. here's the Sun and the Mail representing sort of right, here's the Guardian representing the left, that's Britain. And the BBC as well, that's Britain. Now, as Brexit happened, you probably, as I said, maybe it was the last hurrah of that, you probably got a sense of Brexit Britain if you looked at those institutions. People very angry that it was going a certain way and people very gleeful that it was going in a certain way. I think in 5 years' time, there'll be fewer newspapers. There'll be a lot fewer British national newspapers because I can't see how the Express, the Star, the Mirror survive. I think I can't see how that business model actually ends up functioning.
I can't see that. Those three I thought would be the ones in the firing line. And the other one is like local papers, which I grew up reading obsessively. You know, that's how I got, you know, my into journalism. That was sort of the idea. And I still check my old local newspaper website up in York every day because I'm a bit sad like that and want to know what's going on back home. But you do end up with an idea of what matters in a city and the idea that, you know, certain decisions matter and you get an idea of civic life. And that is going to get completely lost when those papers close, which they almost certainly will.
But we're citizens of nowhere now anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. Hi there. Can we go to the back there? Dive into the middle. Let's take it back and then we'll go to the left. Go on.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to what you were saying before about people going for the absolute very best, as they would on Spotify, for instance. The music industry, for instance, now, there's been a hollowing out of like the middle of it,
yeah.
Whereas you have the garage bands,
yeah.
And then you have the superstars.
Yeah.
Similarly, where are the future writers for the New Yorker or for the Guardian long reads or for BuzzFeed long reads or the TLS? How are they meant to find their way up when the Telegraph and a whole host of other papers on either side of the Atlantic are seeing exoduses of their reporters, huge cuts, and the people who are being kept are being kept in low-skill positions or jobs-for-the-lads positions at the top, and there's not a great deal of opportunity in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, to stretch that music industry point, I got into journalism because I wanted to be a music journalist, but then the market bottomed out of it and somehow ended up on politics. And so I know sort of quite a lot in sort of watching how music changed about sort of 10, 15 years ago. And it's now almost a decade since I got Spotify, so it's so odd to think that there was an age when I used to carry around a bag of CDs with me. But, you know, to really labour that metaphor and to indulge me, in the sort of early 2000s, you could still have your mega selling Franz Ferdinand selling a few million CDs, but you know, and Belle and Sebastian just behind them. But then you'd have your smaller bands doing okay, selling 10 or 20,000 albums a time, but still just about making a living and doing a tour. And that sort of thing, in journalistic terms, is also what's being cut. They can't make a living from doing that full time anymore, and you can't make a living from being the guy who sells stories to the Independent on the side. I used to do FOI stories. 5 years ago, you'd sell them to the Independent. They give you 100 quid in FOI. You could just about make a monthly living wage in London off that if you got a few stories in each national every month. And that's how I got going. And if I was starting out now, I honestly don't know how I'd be able to do that first 6 months in London where I was trying to get a full-time job. And that's me coming from, you know, I was living with a girlfriend at that time and I was getting subsidised rent. And that was, you know, we were still just about getting by. I've no idea how you do it. It's really scary unless you're really rich already.
And what you end up with, actually, is a kind of non-professional type of reporting, which is the fear. You know, what happens when Facebook kills the host? When Facebook, which trades off stories being shared, actually kills off journalism so there are no stories left to be shared or few stories left to be shared. I think that's perfect. So the way the TLS will operate and the way things like the New York will operate, they will use non-reporters to write stuff. Which is fine if you're a literary journal or you're a kind of cultural journal like the New York and the TLS. We will get a professor from Princeton to write for us. We will get a novelist to write for us. That's fine. We're a kind of second job level of publication. The fear is going to be exactly what you're saying, that middle ground, the thing you talked about, that middle ground of meat and vegetables, good, honest reporting, someone who can get a proper living wage digging up stuff about what's going on in the world. It'll either become very high-end super authors or people who have other jobs the actual meat and potatoes stuff is the stuff that starts to ebb away.
And one thing that people don't tend to appreciate outside the industry is, as much as with this talk, things are always improved if you've got the senior editor in their place of the journalist. and so, when I take a story to Janine, who's not here tonight, she can always give you a little bit of feedback to sharpen it. She's got the experience, and you need editors. Editors are amazing. They can always improve something.
Creep.
Is Janine recording this?
That's right.
Hi, Janine. Could
we just take the woman in the, what is it, a green top? Yeah, that one. That one.
In 2016, a new national newspaper was launched, and it closed after 9 weeks. Why do you think it failed? Day. Discuss.
Why did it close?
It was terrible.
It wasn't very good.
Yeah. And the real...
Did anyone work? FYI, I worked on it.
Yeah. I didn't say anything there, John. I was going to say something.
Well, I feel...
Your
awkward.
Stuff was great, yeah. But...
because it... Well, you did, okay, another way of putting it, you didn't have any resources put into it.
Yeah.
You guys had, like, a tiny staff, a couple of news editors, people on secondment... There just wasn't, you didn't have enough put into it.
Can I also say, it didn't have a niche. I think the thing that the New Day suffered from, it's a bit like, in some ways, the Corbyn plot to get elected. You want non-voters to vote. There's a problem with that, they're non-voters. The problem for the New Day is they wanted non-traditional newspaper readers to buy newspapers. And what you said is, we're not going to compete with news, because we can't, we're going to give features. The problem that you had in the end was those sort of features were still being provided for free on the internet, so you weren't offering enough of a niche to say, this is worth spending some money. You then add to that a publisher that didn't back it, a publisher that got cold feet 6 weeks into it, so it pulled it. So there was never really an overpowering vision that if we invest in this for 2 years, this is a niche that needs to be filled, because niche journalism... You can still sell it. It's definitely there to be sold. The problem for New Day in the end was it marketed itself as a niche, and actually it was offering stuff that other people were giving away for free.
And also it was an attempt to sort of do The Eye, but without... I mean, The Eye spent years building up to where it's got to now, where actually The Eye is something that politicians really care about now. They view it as a sort of place that floating voters read, where they can reach an audience who don't normally get reached by other things. It's one, quietly, it's a massive success story.
But it's new. I mean, the point is, New Day said, I remember they changed about, we're not going to do news because news is everywhere. But The Eye is a news newspaper. It breaks stories. It has reporters. So
not many.
It wasn't actually, not many, but some.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, good question. Keep moving across in the middle, right in the middle.
Hi, I was wondering, you spoke a little bit about Facebook killing off journalism, and I was wondering what you'd like to see Facebook doing to prevent that from happening, and what you'd like to see them doing to, I guess, safeguard the quality of the content that people are reading after the fake news.
Hire me on a massive salary as soon as possible.
that's a solution to most problems.
But would you really want to work for Mark?
No, I wouldn't actually. No. I don't think news-wise I'd ever want to.
Carefully. I don't want to rule that out again. This thing's
recorded.
I think I'd be wary of joining any platform like Twitter or Facebook in a journalistic capacity at the moment, or in any way thinking that you could produce journalism from within a place like that. So the interesting thing for me with this fake news thing is all these big newspaper groups seem to be pushing it as a chance to shore up support for the old institutions, the old newspapers. You know, Facebook, you should give a link to a proper news source on this slightly dubious news source so they can click through to the Telegraph's version. Well, for a lot of people on Facebook, they'd be saying, well, I don't want to be linked to the Telegraph's version. I'm reading the InfoWars version particularly because I don't want the Telegraph version.
Yeah.
So what would I like to see them do? I would like them to find some way of rewarding more, for want of a better word, run-of-the-mill, reliable news coverage. But the problem is that it's almost entirely a case of having some sort of subjective process, and that scares me almost as much as the fact that they don't have one. Because the idea that anyone in California is going, plus 3 points on the Daily Mail, plus 2 points on the Express is terrifying.
Yeah, there's a great line from The Simpsons: "I, for one, welcome our alien overlords." And I kind of feel that way about Facebook. I mean, in the end, it's just not worth it to them. So Zuckerberg will—he was a great benefactor in lots of respects, you know—and he's made this business. You know, he's found a niche. He's clever. He's marketing. You can't really argue with it. It's just not in his interest because they want to maintain Facebook as a platform, not a publisher. And by doing that, they want to be able to say to regulators, to politicians all across the world, we don't dabble in this stuff. We're not endorsing this stuff. We're just simply a channel through which it is disseminated. And that's their whole business model because it's got no overheads, it's got no regulatory risk. They'd be crazy to change it, and they're not going to. So what they'll do is they'll talk a good game and they'll talk about fake news and they know. There's an extraordinary thing. ABC in Australia are fact-checking Facebook stories for free. So you have a commercial company giving a service to Facebook so more people will go to Facebook and spend their advertising dollar there than on ABC. Because Facebook is this dominant thing, and that's the thing. They will never want to change that because they're onto a massively good thing.
And don't think of Facebook as a thing for distributing news. I mean, your holiday, you know, it just wants to keep your eyeballs on that app, checking it for updates all the time. So the news is one of the things that keeps you coming back, but it's also your cousin's holiday pictures. It's also whatever your mum is saying about the dog. And stuff like that. And that's just keeping your eyeballs there. So the fact that one of those five things on your news feed is a news story is just a nice way, but they'll keep that balance at the optimum point. It's not about actually giving you news, it's about just keeping your attention in any way possible.
And in a sense, that's a kind of... Facebook has just made manifest real life. I mean, that was our real lives before. News was only ever 2-3% of our real lives, and now our whole lives apparently are on Facebook. It's not surprising, therefore, that news is...
Facebook is the internet. You know, I mean, that's the way to... What Facebook wants
many
to
people,
be,
yeah.
The internet.
Yeah.
The portal to everything.
Yeah. Yeah, delete your accounts. I didn't say that either, because I'm going to go see you have lunch with Facebook tomorrow, so better not.
Do pass on our bet.
Give me that research grant.
So for Jim, to come at this kind of from a US story, when BuzzFeed published the Trump dossier, there was like...
Oh, I thought we almost made it.
I was going to ask him that.
It's really close.
Yeah. There were a lot of people who were receptive to that, but then there was also a reaction that was more like, this is cool, but could this be good political journalism if it's coming from a site that publishes like 17 mind-blowingly cute pictures of like dogs in Halloween costumes? So how does...
That's a great list.
So how does a site like BuzzFeed that does have like quality political journalism kind of overcome that stigma?
I'm slightly arrogantly, maybe. I think we almost have. We're close to it. When I joined, like, it used to be like, what is this on BuzzFeed? Then people would tweet out the link. For about a year, it was, I can't believe I'm linking to BuzzFeed, but this is sort of all right. And then it was like, weirdly, okay from BuzzFeed. And then it's like, great scoop from BuzzFeed. You know, like, we semi-expect that. So I think in a certain world we're there, and maybe we got a bit further to go, and there's always further to go. We're not really worried by that anymore. I mean, we have hundreds of millions of people watching food videos. We have hundreds of millions of people doing that. We want to be a bit like the BBC. You can watch Bake Off, and you can then turn over to Newsnight. You can do both from the same place. So I'm not fussed about that. And in terms of... do you think we were right to publish the dossier? Great, okay, well, I agree with you completely.
that ethical dilemma is solved. Yeah, have you had... I think it's curious as well that when you did do that, and I actually fell on your side of the fence, that it was...
It was a very odd situation.
Very, so very...
Is everyone aware of what we're talking about?
You know, Russian hotel? Well, you explain.
Yes.
Interesting
thing. So, the story was that a lot of outlets were working on standing up this document... we were one of them. We were flying reporters all around the world. Actually, I don't really think that's been much sort of talked about. We were flying reporters all around the world trying to stand up key bits of it. And we had a contingency plan because we knew at least sort of half a dozen other outlets were doing exactly the same. And CNN published a great scoop revealing certain details which it had sort of stood up in some respect. And then, but weirdly, and we did not expect this, didn't publish the document itself. So it reported at length on the document without showing it. And I think, frankly, the thinking was to us, we're moving on CNN's story, and instead it became something more about whether we were revealing key details. So it was a bit of an odd one because we viewed it very much as CNN has written about this document, everyone else is writing about this document, we are showing you the document that is being discussed. But then it was viewed quite differently.
It's quite remarkable the way that, you know, when you did that decision, that people, you know, saw it as a massive statement. But it's such a wacky circus around Trump and everything that I think people have just forgotten about it. You know, we just... You know, both your decision to publish it, but also the thing itself.
But also, I think BuzzFeed benefits by being to a
that would have lasted a normal newspaper 6 months.
Yeah.
Following up on that and the reaction to
it. I think also BuzzFeed benefits by a bit on the side of the angels in regard to that particular person, Donald Trump, and the particular circumstance. And he is in no moral position to start declaiming about the ethical decisions of BuzzFeed. He can't really do it because the two are not comparable, bearing in mind the stuff he says and the stuff he does. So you can have an argument about whether BuzzFeed pushing it out without actually getting to the end of the standing up process, simply to say, as they did very clearly, this is being discussed about, we want our readers to know what is being discussed about. I think if another organisation had done it, they'd have been criticised more than BuzzFeed.
Yeah, I agree.
But BuzzFeed has with it, and this is perfectly legitimate for it to have, it has a certain amount of, it doesn't do this stuff a lot, it doesn't break really sort of ethically contentious along the line decisions very often, deliberately so. It has a very clear guidelines in that respect. And secondly, if you're doing something like that to Trump, you can't really allow Trump to claim the moral high ground over BuzzFeed because he doesn't have it.
Although that was the argument, wasn't it? That, you know, you've allowed Trump to say,
we're a failing pile of garbage.
You're a failing pile of garbage.
Well, the one upside was within 3 hours we had T-shirts and garbage bins with that printed on them selling out and raised about $30,000 for a journalist.
Yeah,
so at least something good came out of it.
Okay, I think we can just squeeze in a couple more. I'm going to take a guy in the pink and let's do something very dramatic and go right to the very back. Right to the very back. Just quickly say your question. We'll take the other one as well.
So very quickly, I saw a thing the other day in the New York Times saying some kind of billionaire should buy Twitter as a kind of exercise in, you know, protecting the public from itself. Do you think there's any kind of model for philanthropy-funded journalism going forward?
Right, philanthropy-funded. And the question at the back.
Yes, today in the digital era of journalism, how do journalists that work in more traditional media coexist with marketers and marketers within the paper? And how close do they like to be? Or is it that journalists need to be, to some extent, a little bit marketers as well?
That's good. Do you do philanthropy? So, I mean, we sort of got philanthropy.
So on philanthropy, I'm personally strongly in favour of journalism that makes money, or at least for a company that makes money, because I think you actually keep your audience in mind then. A lot of really good journalism is done by non-profit institutes, but tends to end up sort of being 12,000-word sort of slightly thesis-esque documents when I do sometimes go, tell me the scandalous detail by paragraph two or I'm just going to get bored and click on something else. So I think, I hope that there's a future for commercial journalism because otherwise you end up with slightly odd priorities and lose track of who your audience
is. It's funny though, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's probably more competitive than ever in a way, journalism.
Yeah.
And people often think that's a bad thing, that somehow journalism should exist like a sort of, well, I don't like a more academic.
The one fear that keeps me going is getting scooped. Yeah. That awful, crushing feeling when you know something and never quite got round to writing it and then find someone else is getting told that they're a genius for publishing it.
Yeah.
It's crushing.
And I think, like you say, I want the TLS always to make money. I want the TLS to make more money because I think in the end it becomes more independent. It becomes more of a thing you can have confidence in. If you're saying this isn't always, you say it, if an audience pays for it, they value it. If they value it, there's a future in it. If it's being given to them by someone who thinks it's good for them, you then run into all sorts of risks of, is this person really a genuinely benevolent person? And I work for a company where at least not many people think that. But the idea is, even with News Corp, it's a commercial entity. It's there to make money. And there's a certain type of clarity about that.
It's probably more intimate now, isn't it, in the sense that most journalists can now look at Chartbeat. They can see how many clicks their particular story is or isn't getting, etc. And they can see the advertising, whatever it is, floating around their particular... I know you've got a different business model at BuzzFeed, but there is a much closer... I don't know what... The old Chinese walls is gone.
That's true.
It's much closer.
And that goes to the question of how we should...
And you're supposed to market your own journalism. If you publish something, you're supposed to go on Twitter and tell the world how marvellous it is.
And The Verge, actually, I mean...
to take a very old-fashioned, I mean, Jim will have a better view of sort of native advertising as how journalists and marketeers are working together, but the TLS is a kind of old-fashioned example of this. The commercial guy sits with us in our office, and so does the marketeer. And so we publish stuff knowing what the advertising guy is selling. We actually theme editions. So the paper that you've got in front of you is Russian Revolution paper. We knew we were doing this 4 months ago. He sold adverts for people with publishers selling Russian books in it. There's nothing creepy about that. We knew we were going to do this stuff, and then he could sell adverts directly to it. It's a kind of interesting old-fashioned symbiosis that goes on. And I think that's really, really important. You've got to know your audience. You've got to know what they want. And the same is true for digital content. In the end, digital content for a business like the TLS, the purpose of it is for people to come in, like it, bounce around, read three or four, and think, I'm going to subscribe to the TLS as a result of it. There's nothing wrong with actually just being honest with everyone concerned. That is what we're doing. We're creating a funnel. Mm. And actually, we believe that quality will be a way of getting people into that funnel. So being nakedly commercial feels like it should be kind of completely contrary to an institution like the TLS, or even BuzzFeed to an extent, because of its principles. But actually, I think if you bind it together properly, it becomes a virtue.
You just got to keep the trust of the readers, and if you lose that, we have to have, because what we create as advertising is very similar to in what it looks like to our actual content. We have to keep internally the two teams very separate, or else we'd lose all trust. However, you know, if our tasty videos, which are incredibly popular on Facebook, where you get disembodied hands making recipes, the way we do that with that is Philadelphia come along and say, we'd like to give you a lot of money, and you have to make a recipe that requires Philadelphia. Well, I don't really think that's lying if you say, you know, Philadelphia paid for this, this one requires it. You're not required to go out and buy some, but here's an idea that you might like, and it's just slotted in. It's just about if it feels icky, it's probably wrong, and if it doesn't, then it probably doesn't matter.
There you go. Immediate ethics summarized.
I've been wasting my time all these years.
You've got a career on that, Charlie.
And any students out there who think they can use that quote in their thesis, just forget it. Okay, listen, we're going to stop there. Thank you very, very much for your fantastic questions. Thank you especially, for Jim for stepping in and being Janine, as it were. You're absolutely marvellous. And thank you very much, Stig Abel, as well. Thanks a lot, guys.